Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in the studio right now is author Steve Leto. He is here to speak to some folks at Michigan Tech about his latest book, Preston Tucker, and the Battle to Build the Car of Tomorrow. Steve, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here.
Had you on here before. One of your previous books, we've talked about Death's Door, the Sieberville murders. They're always, interesting reads, and you do a lot of tremendous research and come up with some of the most interesting topics for a book.
Mm-hmm.
So let's kind of start with this one. Tell me a little bit about who Preston Tucker is and why it intrigued you to, write a book about him.
Well, Preston Tucker tried to start a car company right after World War II, and it was actually a huge, huge thing at the time. He was in the news for several years straight, and then he kind of disappeared, and they made a movie about him called Preston Tucker, The Man in the Dream, that Francis Ford Coppola directed, and it came out, I think, 88 or 89, and so I was familiar with the story, and I actually have a friend who's a Tucker expert, a guy who lives near Detroit who's actually bought and sold a few Tuckers and restored a few Tuckers, and he knows more about Tuckers than almost anybody alive, and he said, Steve, you should write a book about Tucker, and I said, well, they just made that movie. And he said, no, but the movie wasn't based on a book. It was based on just, they did interviews with the family members to get the story. And I said, you're kidding me. And I did some research and found out that there'd never been a good modern biography written of Preston Tucker. So I started doing research and got into it.
Now, what's his connection with Michigan?
Well, he was born in Capac, Michigan, which is in the Thumb. Spent a couple years in Everett, Michigan, which is northern Lower Peninsula. And then he spent the bulk of his life, though, in the Ypsilanti area. And he bought and sold cars his entire life. He was a car seller, primarily a car salesman. And he, born in 1903. So he was growing up along with the auto industry. And he discovered a knack for selling cars. And so he was a car salesman, then a dealer manager, then a sales manager, zone manager. He had every salesman or managerial job you could have in car sales in his early adulthood. And everyone who knew him said this guy could sell anything to anybody.
Now, I grew up in the Metro Detroit area in the shadow of the big three automakers. So I want to say this, other than the movie, which I remember seeing back when I was in high school, the story of Tucker is not something that I'm familiar with, or probably many people are.
No, and that's the thing. I meet a lot of people. I'm 55 years old, and I meet people of the generation slightly older than me, and many of them remember Tucker. And I actually was at a talk downstate a couple days ago, and a woman came up to me and she said, "When I was a little girl, I saw a Tucker automobile brought to town, and it was a huge, huge event. Everyone, oh, we have to go see the Tucker, go see the Tucker." And it's kind of funny because all these years later, she remembered it. I showed her a picture in the book and I said, "There's one." She said, "Oh, that's the same color, And I mean, it was a vivid memory. And think back to when you're a child, if you would actually remember a car that vividly, but Tucker was a big deal.
Tell me a little bit how he, about his dream and what he wanted to do.
Well, many people don't know this, but during World War II, the federal government ordered car companies to stop building cars. We needed the factories, we needed the manufacturing capability to build weapons and army trucks and army tanks and airplanes. So they didn't build cars from 42 to 45. And so everyone knew in 45 the war is going to end soon. And when the war ends, the first thing most people are going to do is buy a new car because the car they're driving is falling apart. And so everyone recognized there's going to be a huge market for cars. So the big three automakers simply said, well, we're just going to go back and start building 1942 cars because nobody will care that it's a three-year-old car. They just want a new car. And Preston Tucker said, wait a second. If I could raise the money and start a car company, I could build a car from the ground up. I'm not stuck with the legacy problems of the automakers. So if you started with a blank slate, you'd build a car a little different. So he goes, I'm going to build a car that's rear engine, rear wheel drive. It's going to be safe, and it's going to have a bunch of the modern things that were coming out at the time, like, say, fuel injection and disc brakes. Now, some of those things didn't get into the car, but the point was simply that he could start with a clean slate and design a car as he wanted to. And so he actually met with some designers, described a car to them, and they drew a design of a car that's fairly streamlined for 1948. And when word got out that Preston Tucker, well-known car seller, well-known businessman, was going to launch his own car company, it actually became a national phenomenon. I mean, there were people writing in letters to him by the tens of thousands saying, I want to buy one of your cars. When will they be available?
I try to think about, how impossible it would be today if you were to, try to start an auto company.
Yeah.
If you were to try to actually build a car that was marketable. And probably not even that much different back then. It had to be a huge uphill battle to even get the first car rolling off the production line.
Yeah, and that's, you're right. He had to raise like $15 to $20 million to do it. And he did it with an initial public offering, an IPO. And nowadays, we hear about IPOs all the time, where Snapchat or Google or Facebook, you know, they say sell stock and everyone becomes billionaires overnight. Well, it was less common in 1947 or 1948 to do an IPO and actually get much attention for it. But when Tucker did his, he got a lot of attention because he'd gotten so much publicity when he had announced his car was going to get built in the first place. So he raised the money, and he actually got the access to a factory in Chicago that was a former bomber plant run by the government. And when the war ended, the government actually sold off war assets, and they gave him the use of this plant to build, you know, build his cars in. And he built a prototype, which they nicknamed the Tin Goose. And it looked like one of his cars, and it was dark red, or it was red. And they unveiled it to the public. And just at the unveiling of his car, tens of thousands of people came to see it. It was standing room only at this gigantic factory. And it was like the best ticket in town in Chicago. It was to get in and watch this guy unveil his car. And it was just kind of strange. It was almost like a show business thing. And it was, I mean, I've seen photographs, I've seen film of it. And it was this gigantic event. And so he got all this stuff lined up and put together and raised $20 million in 1948 dollars. That's a lot of money. And so he actually got right to the edge where he's going to be able to build and mass produce these wonderful, you know, cars of tomorrow.
Well, how did the established automakers view this effort? I mean, this new star on the scene and with a, you know, kind of an idea that's going to go against the grain as far as they're concerned.
Well, and, you know, they point out in the movie, for instance, that there were people in the Big Three who kind of looked at him askance. And there's a couple of reasons why. And one of them was he was touting his cars. They were going to be safer. And nobody was talking about auto safety in the 1940s. Seatbelts weren't put in cars till 1960s. And Tucker said, you know, my car is going to have a padded dashboard. It's going to have a roof that's strong enough if the car were to roll over, it wouldn't crush, which they proved, and that actually worked. The windshield will pop out if you're in an accident, so you're not going to put your head through the glass, which was a common thing back then. And there were people who didn't like him pointing out these things. But the Big Three, I don't think, were as worried about him as they made it to be in the movies, because the Big Three weren't the only game in town anyways. There was also Kaiser, Frazier, Nash, Hudson. There were a lot of car companies back then. And everyone kind of thought, like, hey, we can all build cars and probably all make money. But I think the real enemies that he had were in Washington, D.C., who looked at him and said, wait, this guy is raising $20 million through an IPO, but he hasn't even built a car yet. And they were concerned that he was running a scam. He wasn't. But there were some people who raised eyebrows and said, wait, he's raised $20 million to start building cars, but he hasn't even built one yet. And he did build the prototype before the IPO. But building one car isn't as hard as you think when it comes to, you know, comparing it to building dozens of cars or hundreds of cars or an entire assembly line, you know, cranking out cars on a daily basis.
So he actually got to the point where he was could begin manufacturing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what many people I talk to, they say, well, you know, I've seen one, and they think that he only built a couple. He actually built 51 cars. And that doesn't sound like a lot of cars, but I've got photographs in the book where there's cars coming down an assembly line, and they were actually turning out cars on a regular basis. They were just getting the bugs worked out. And I've spoken to people in the automotive industry who'll tell you that when you bring down a new model, you build a prototype of it, and then you start building pilot models until you work the bugs out. Then you start production. So Tucker was still in that pilot model production phase of things, but he got 50 cars built. But unfortunately, right at that time, just as he was about to hit the gas and start making cars, the federal government showed up, and in the form of Securities and Exchange Commission investigators with subpoenas. And they walked into the factory and said, we're here to investigate you. They wouldn't tell them why. And they started just hauling stuff out of the factory as part of their investigation. They took all of his correspondence, all of his blueprints, all of his contracts, everything, to the point where he couldn't operate. And he had to shut the factory down so the government could investigate his operation.
They didn't say why. Was this related to their suspicion that he was a scammer? Because by that time, it couldn't be a scam anymore. He's born in a production line.
Well, that's the thing. And that's what fueled it. And so what happened was they created this big report, a 650-page report, the Securities and Exchange Commission did. And it was this top-secret report. And they created this report, and they gave it to their director, and they said, here's the report, the conclusions we've come to. And the weird thing is that the SEC was only allowed to investigate stock offerings. And when Tucker had proposed his stock offering, the SEC had approved it. So it's kind of hard to go back and say, well, we approved the stock offering, so we're now going to somehow find you guilty of doing something with that. So they were scratching their head, and they weren't sure what to do. So instead, they took the report, and they leaked it to the press. And they actually gave a copy of the report to some Detroit news reporters, and they gave a copy of it to a guy named Drew Pearson, who was a muckraker who had a nationally syndicated radio show. And overnight, Sunday night to Monday morning, two stories broke. One was the Drew Pearson story on the radio, where he came out and he said, Preston Tucker's a fraud. The whole thing's a fraud. If you put money in this company, it's gone. Kiss it goodbye. And the Detroit News ran a headline, Tucker fraud. And then down beneath said, you know, Securities and Exchange Commission report accuses him of fraud. But they weren't in a position to do anything about it. Well, because of the clamor and outcry from people who were going, oh my gosh, you know, Tucker's a fraud, they decided to prosecute him and a bunch of his executives in Chicago for Securities and Exchange Commission violations, mail fraud, a bunch of things. And they wound up putting him on trial. The trial took 6 months along with all of his associates. And the trial was so poorly conducted from the prosecution's viewpoint that when they were done and they arrested, the defendants stood up and said, you know, Your Honor, this case is so weak, we're not even going to defend it. Let's go straight to closing arguments. And they did. And the jury came back almost instantly, not guilty, all defendants, all counts. Tucker hadn't done anything wrong.
But by then, damage had been done, especially in the court of public opinion.
He was, well, yeah, and besides that, while he was on trial, just to make sure he was done, some people pushed his company into involuntary bankruptcy, and the company was actually taken from him because it's a corporation. They took the company from him, they auctioned off all the assets, the company was gone. So, you know, there's a famous picture of him walking out of the courthouse smiling and waving like, hey, everybody, I just won. But his company was gone, his name was ruined, he was broke. And so that was the end of it for the Tucker automobile dream.
Was there anything about Tucker the man that the federal government would have been concerned about? Because he sounds like the, you know, kind of the American dream type of person, an entrepreneur with a bright idea, raises the money, he's got a great idea for a, you know, innovative product, and the gumshoe to go ahead and, you know, get it started and get it going. Is there anything about the government that looked at him and said, you know, this is somebody we want to stop?
Well, I think they were concerned because they looked at Tucker and they said, okay, here's a guy who's a salesman. He's a car salesman. And he sold stock to the public and he raised like $20 million with a couple different things he did. He raised $20 million. What's to keep him from just taking the money and running away? Well, there wasn't anything keeping him from doing that. But he didn't do that. And I think that Harry McDonald, who was the head of the SEC at the time, who clearly had it in for Tucker because he's the one who leaked these reports to the press, I think that Harry McDonald was just thinking to himself, like what a strange situation we've created where someone can raise money without even having like a product in production. But you know, nowadays, we don't think anything about that. Elon Musk is selling electric cars, and there's a model he has coming out, and we're not sure if it's coming out next month or next year. He's taking deposits of thousands of dollars per car. The cars haven't been built yet. There's no delivery date promised, and he's doing it. And Elon Musk is doing the exact same thing Tucker did. And there's other people who've done that as well. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, if you can make the cars, great. And Tucker was building the cars. He was actually making the cars. And famously, in the movie, they demonstrated this. But also, during the trial, the prosecution had actually said he never built any cars. And the defense attorneys would stand up and say, Your Honor, we can bring you 4 dozen cars tomorrow. We'll circle the block with them. And the judge said, you know, guys, something that's irrelevant. Because he's not being accused of not building cars. He's being accused of not wanting to build cars. And the defense is like, what's the difference? If he built the cars, he must have intended to build cars, right? I mean, call me crazy.
Right. I kind of picture that the concern was that he might have been a 1940s version of a Bernie Madoff or something
like
that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, well, so 51 cars were made. What happened to the cars?
Well, amazingly, 47 of them still exist. We know where the 4 that aren't around are. We know what happened to them. One of them got burned in a fire, one was in a car accident, and one was destructively tested by Tucker himself or his company. There's one that got dismantled. We're not sure where the parts of it have popped up here and there. But the 47 remaining cars, many are in museums or in private collections. If you can find a complete Tucker, just simply a complete Tucker that's there, all the pieces are there, it's worth $1 million. And one of them sold at auction recently for $3.2 million. And I've seen the cars. They're beautiful. And, you know, the cars aren't the greatest cars ever built because these were still experimental in the terms of they're still working out the bugs of manufacturing them. But the fact that these cars are on the road, you know, 60 years, 70 years later, and commanding those kind of prices is actually a testament to something. You know, and Tucker himself died of lung cancer in 1956. But these cars have gone on. To me, that's the legacy, to prove that what he was doing was real, because the cars are real. The cars are going to outlive us all.
Have you ever seen one of the Tuckers?
Yeah, I've seen them. Yeah. I've seen a whole bunch of them. I've never driven one. There's a couple weird oddities of how you drive them, but I've seen several of them. I've probably seen 5 or 10, including 2 or 3 that weren't in museums. But like the Smithsonian's got one, the Henry Ford Museum's got one. And so if you want to see a Tucker, they're not that hard to find, and they're not hard to spot either, because they've got that, what they call the Cyclops headlight. One of the most famous features of the Tucker automobile was there's a headlight in the middle, and it turned with the wheel. So if you're going around a corner, the thinking was this thing would illuminate the corner for you back when headlights weren't so good.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
So those cars, those ones that were made, did they ever end up like for sale at a dealership, or did they just instantly become collector type of vehicles?
Well, some of them actually did get out and get sold, but the most part, many of them were simply on the assembly line. They were completed, and then the factory got shut down. So many of them got auctioned. So when the assets of the corporation were sold, a whole bunch of the vehicles got auctioned off. At auction, many of the cars sold for $2,500, which is what Tucker was proposing to sell them for. But people were buying the car knowing that the company is defunct, they couldn't get spare parts, the car came with no warranty, and no one knew at that time how good they were going to be, and they still sold. Which to me is also an indication of something that Tucker had done right, that people look at the car and go, yeah, it's worth a couple $1,000s, which is back then was a selling price of a car.
Oh. So what happened to the Tucker after this whole to-do?
Well, after this was all done, Tucker moved back to Ypsilanti. He had a machine shop, which he'd been running the entire time, and he still owned it. So he kept running that, and he started toying with the idea about trying to start something else, but he's having trouble because, unfortunately, the name Tucker became synonymous with fraud. And so what Tucker did was, he was looking around at the idea of starting something else, and then he developed lung cancer. And in 1955 or 56, lung cancer, the diagnosis was a death sentence. So it was literally to him, it was just simply, how much time have I got left? So he wound up spending his last year or two in Ypsilanti quietly with his family. He had a huge family, lots of kids, grandkids. I got some great photographs of him in the book with his family and his extended family. In fact, many of them are still around in this, you know, in Michigan, the Michigan area. I'm very good friends with John Tucker, who is Preston Tucker's grandson. And, you know, they're all doing what they can to keep the legacy alive and, you know, going to events. And I went to the Tucker Automobile Club of America's annual meeting last year in Ypsilanti. There were two Tuckers there, two of the cars there, but like 4 Tuckers in terms of the family members who were there. And it's kind of neat to speak to people who have a connection to the story like that.
That's pretty amazing. And kind of, you know, previews what I was just about to ask is, you know, your research into this book, you've had to have talked to a lot of these, you know, family members and people with, you know, first or you know, if not firsthand knowledge of the cars being built and knowing Tucker, certainly very close. You know, what was your, just sort of your impression of the legacy that he left behind?
Well, and that, you know, that I spoken to his grandchildren. I spoke to his daughter-in-law. And it's funny because I also read accounts of people who worked with him. And overwhelmingly, everybody agrees, he was just a really nice guy, but he was also the consummate salesman. And he probably could have made a living as a salesman or a sales manager if he had simply, when he got back to Michigan after the whole fiasco with the trial, and said, you know, I'm just going to go back and sell stuff. He could sell stuff. But I think at that point, he's a little disillusioned, because he was a guy who believed in the American dream, who actually thought like, hey, you know, you start a car company or you start a company and you go out and sell something. And if it's a good product and you sell it well and people are happy with it, you'll make money. And of course, that's not what happened to him, you know. And to him, I think the ultimate betrayal was the fact that the U.S. government came after him and shut him down, and he never could wrap his head around it. He went to his deathbed convinced that GM had done it. He thought that the big three car companies, especially General Motors, had gone to D.C. and pushed for people to come after him. Now, people did come after him, like the SEC and so on, but we don't know if they were pushed. But Tucker was convinced that it was the automakers using the government as like unfair competition. And we don't know if that's true or not, but it certainly makes a great plot for a movie, which is what it did.
Yeah, certainly. The car itself, did the other car companies look at the Tucker and say, well, that actually is a pretty good idea? Did any of those innovations get adopted?
Right now, and my understanding is the Toyota auto manufacturing company in Japan has a museum where they have in what they consider to be like the most important automotive examples of things that were done in the industry. They've got a Tucker. They actually have it, and it's in a prominent display position in their museum because they believe that the Tucker was so far advanced, and they liked the fact that he was thinking completely outside of the box. And, you know, when you look at the Tucker today and it looks like an old car, and I had people say, oh, that's, there's nothing special about that. That car is space age for 1948. It's streamlined. Nobody thought of streamlining in the 40s. Look at another car. Look at a Hudson from 1948. It's a box. It looks like a toaster on wheels, you know? And the Tucker was streamlined, and he put a lot of thought into just not how did it look, but was it functional? And if you look at the dashboard in the Tucker, it's very clean and very simple. But then the dashboard itself is padded. And we have padded dashboards in cars now and don't think anything about it. Back in 1948, a dashboard in a car was often a big chunk of rusty, chromed iron that if you hit it at more than 5 miles an hour, it'd probably impale you, okay? And he was actually thinking about these things. And the fact that he used those as design cues, he'd go to his designers and say, I want the interior to be safe. And he'd go to the guys who did the exterior and go, I want the car to be streamlined. And to say, like, I want it rear engine, rear wheel drive for better traction. Nowadays, many cars are front engine, front wheel drive, which is the same concept, just spun around. So he was advanced for wanting to put all of these things into one package. And that's what the Tucker automobile was.
As I mentioned at the beginning, you're in town now to talk with folks at Michigan Tech.
Yeah.
Interesting story. Why bring it to Tech, though?
Well, a couple reasons. The book was named a Michigan Notable Book by the Library of Michigan, and they sponsor us to go out, the authors to go out and speak at libraries. And the libraries can choose from a list of authors. And they actually asked for me specifically because Tech, of course, is an engineering school. And a lot of the people at Tech wind up in the auto industry. I've got friends who went to Tech who now work for Ford, GM, and Chrysler. And so, you know, there's a lot of students who are being, you know, sitting in classrooms talking to professors and hearing lectures on auto design, auto safety, automotive technology. And it's important to understand the history of this stuff. You know, you can go today and walk into a auto manufacturer and just start working on a vehicle, but you got to know where the stuff came from and why it's the way it is, you know? And so I think that this is a great look at a slice of the history of the auto industry because he was ahead of his time and he predicted a lot of things that were going to happen. You know, he wanted to put seatbelts in his cars in 1948 and his own people wouldn't let him. It's the only battle he ever lost that I know of because they said, you don't put seatbelts in cars. That's like handing up parachutes on airplanes. You know, if you did that, people would assume the airplane's going to crash. They said, if you put a seatbelt in a car, it's saying the car's unsafe. And he's like, no, all cars should have seatbelts. And of course, he's right. All cars now have seatbelts and shoulder harnesses and airbags and padded dashboards.
Talking right now with Steve Leto. He is the author of Preston Tucker and his battle to build the car of tomorrow. Steve, when did the book come out?
The book came out just a couple months ago. It did win a Michigan Notable Book Award. And so, you know, it's actually doing very well. The Wall Street Journal gave me a huge write-up on one of their weekend editions, which is nice. And it's been mentioned in a lot of other places. It's, you know, it's on sale nationally, and it's actually doing very, very well. So I'm really excited because my publisher, who also put out my Turbin Car book, they were skeptical. They go, Steve, car books don't sell. And I said, it's not a car book. It's a story about, an American dream. And I start selling it to them like Tucker would sell a car, you know. And my publisher has now admitted to me it's their best-selling book.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you have a foreword here by Jay Leno.
Yeah, Jay Leno wrote the foreword for this book. I know Jay from a couple books back. And Jay does not own a Tucker, but he's very familiar with them. And he actually owns a car called a Tatra, which is a Czechoslovakian car. And if you saw it, you go, wait, that's kind of like a European Tucker? Like, what is that? And it was a car with a front center headlight, rear engine, rear wheel drive, but it was pre-war, built in 1938. And so we think that Tucker got some of his design ideas from looking at the Tatra. And I visited Jay Leno in his garage with all his car collection. And we were walking by and I saw the Tatra and I did a double take. I said, that's not a Tucker, but what is it? And he goes, that's the Tatra, which probably inspired Tucker on some of his ideas. So we had a long discussion about Tuckers. And then later on when I wrote the book, I said, would you be willing to write the foreword? And he goes, absolutely. Because he loves Tuckers. He loves the story. He hasn't got a Tucker yet, but I think one of these days he might.
Okay. He's got the money.
He's got the money to buy them all if he wanted to.
Okay. I think I remember that Leno was a big car guy from his days on The Tonight Show.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is very interesting. I'm looking forward to, I don't know if I'll be able to get this copy or get my own.
That copy is yours. I'll sign it in a moment.
Awesome. For everybody else who doesn't have their own radio show and getting a signed copy directly from you, how can they get a copy?
Bookstores should have it. Book World will have it here in Houghton, of course. And then if you have to, go on the internet, jump on Amazon. They've got it as well.
Steve, real quick before I let you go, what's next on the pipeline?
You know, I've got a couple ideas I'm kicking around, but nothing firm yet, so I'm always looking for good ideas. Okay. We'll see.
Right.
We'll see.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.